It is Monday, the 18th of March, 2019. We are at a home in Palmerston North. This recording is for broadcast on Manawatu Two Peoples Radio and for storage in an archive. It may be made available for public use, and we are happy with that. Today I have with me
Eddie Eggers.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Eddie, you were a psychologist working in the education department.
Yeah, in the education field.
So over what period were you doing that work?
I started doing that work in late 1974.
Yeah.
And I retired 2003.
Okay, so nearly 30 years and before and after tomorrow's school.
25
yeah,
years.
Yeah, 25.
Yeah. Before and after tomorrow's schools came about, yes.
So were there many changes from that? What did the work involve in the when you first started?
Well, when I first started, there was a focus within the office. There were five psychologists, and there were two or three other people as well doing different things, working with kids with special needs. But the initial focus was on those with intellectual disabilities or learning problems. Psychologists then, and I wasn't part of that group, they'd have done work involving resolution of behaviour problems. Mm. And all the work stemmed from requests from schools for somebody to come, and they'd put in a written referral which would record background information on the child and things related to their education and placement and what the concerns were. And then a member of the psych service would go to the school when possible and have a preliminary interview with principal usually and probably the class teacher and determine things a little bit more detail and then work out what a possible strategy might be. Because we were into assessment back then, and the assessment virtually always involved an intellectual assessment.
Okay.
Now, you did those using standardised tests, and based on the results, you determined what might happen for some of the kids in terms of their placements, because we had special classes for backward children, as they were then termed, a horrible term.
In normal schools? Or?
Yeah. But not every school had them. Sometimes kids would leave a school from which they were referred in order to go to a school with such a special class. And that could have involved transport by taxi from home to the school, both ways, morning and afternoon. Their placement would be reviewed periodically to determine whether they should still stay or not.
Yeah. So you were just dealing with children that were in normal schools. Some may have special provision, but were other children going to cater for
One of the way? Other aspects of the work I did was working with kids who were already in the special classes or a special school for intellectually handicapped children.
Okay.
And we were required every 2 years at least to reassess those.
So what were, there were special schools for intellectually handicapped?
Yes. We only had one here in Palmerston North, for example.
Okay.
But we had several special classes for...
Okay.
Well, they were called backward children then. Which
within the mainstream schools?
Yes, but they would have been school classes to which kids from other schools might be transferred in. Depending on the room available and so on.
Okay. Yeah. And what about physical disabilities then?
At that stage, no, we weren't doing anything about those, really.
Were they treated anywhere? What did they do about education? Were they in the normal schools?
Yes, by and large they were.
Okay, so blind children as well, for example? Or deaf children?
No.
The first... work that we did in relation to kids with visual disabilities was in the early 80s, because I'd helped organise a seminar here at Palmerston North on children with visual impairments and difficulties. And it was about that time that we did a first survey for the area on the incidence of such kids. We recognised there was a need for special assistance, but in order for them to get assistance, they had to be identified through work with an ophthalmic specialist, and then they had to go to Homeite College in Auckland. And some of them would travel up there with their parents and be assessed. And
For an assessment? Or
for an assessment.
So what, before then, what happened to them? Would they...
They'd just be in classrooms, and they'd cope or they wouldn't cope.
Okay.
Yeah. Not very satisfactory at all.
And those with hearing issues?
They had an advisor on deaf children who covered a huge territory from New Plymouth all the way to Hawke's Bay, big territory, and the guy who did that worked his butt off seeing kids because he had an assessment role and an advice giving role. He worked in relation to the kids in the schools and also with the parents giving them advice. So that was a huge range. However, over time, when he retired, in fact, he was replaced by two similar fellows to do that work. But coming back to the visual side of things, when we had the first survey, we started off getting schools and teachers to indicate children that they were concerned about who might have visual impairments.
Yeah.
And the first survey came up with a very substantial number. And these were children that we thought needed special assistance way above what classroom teachers could really provide. And then in the late 80s, after that survey, approval was given to establish a central resource centre.
Okay. So when did tomorrow's schools come in? Because there was a change in system.
I think it was about 89, Anne.
Right.
Somewhere about there.
So before then, there was talk about mainstreaming, but you're saying really a lot of these children were in the standard schools anyway.
They were mainstreamed, effectively.
They were already mainstreamed before tomorrow's school.
But mainstreamed without additional assistance, by and large.
Okay.
Tomorrow's schools and what followed on led to the government providing... quantities of time, money, therefore teacher aides, who would work with the kids we identified as having needs. And that sort of changed over time, became modified a bit. So you had kids with substantial needs and they'd get an allocation of teacher aid hours out of the communal type bucket for the area. And so they might get 1 or 2 hours a day. Some would get substantially more than that. But all the way through, consistently, we could see that there wasn't enough to meet the need to ensure that the kids got sufficient assistance to help their learning.
Yeah. Did the teachers in their teacher training develop some expertise for coping with children like
that? For the general class teachers, not as a rule, no.
Okay.
It was a bit like, if I can make a comparison away from this, back when I started teaching in the late 50s, up until the time I started teaching, I'd had virtually no instruction on how to teach reading. And I'd been a teacher for 10 or 12 years before I started to understand what teaching reading and learning reading was about. And we had one advisor in the area in which I was to schools on reading. So he'd come out and work with teachers and do some training programs to encourage them in how to teach kids reading. Now, all those systems were refined over time, and more skills gained both by the specialist coming in, such as psychologists and advisors on the one hand, but also by teachers. But there were things that happened research-wise where inquiry showed that there'd been very little opportunity for classroom teachers, and I'm talking about way after the period I talked about in my beginning teaching, when inquiry of teachers, there was a research project done which asked teachers, well, how much in-service training have you had on teaching reading? And majority of teachers had had none, certainly none in the preceding 12 months or longer. So they were just getting on doing what they could. I don't know how the situation's different now. It's better that I don't comment on that, I think.
Yeah. Was New Zealand similar to other English-speaking countries at that time?
I can hear my wife chuckling in the background.
But because, she said she didn't want to say anything. In this.
Well, we had a year living in Pennsylvania. I had a scholarship there for a year to study special education, and in that year we got to visit a lot of schools and see a lot of classrooms and learn a lot about what they were doing for kids with special needs. But in effect it wasn't a heck of a lot. So mainstreaming, sometimes they refer to it as main dumping, because no specific provision was made to meet a kid's need, even though they were entitled to be in a mainstream type situation. That didn't necessarily give them access to extra or special assistance. Here, I think something of the same would be true, but we had programs and we had instructional materials that were vastly superior to most anything you'd find anywhere else in the world in that period. And I think that would still be true. In America, for example, our sons were both in the school there, elementary and middle school, and so they'd roll up for the first day of the school year and here's your reading book for the year. So the reading book might have been, you know, let's say it was 150 pages or 200 pages thick, and that was their instructional material for the year. And so they went through a very formal learning process, everybody in the class reading from the same page, basically, without reference to their actual level of achievement or anything. So those who weren't achieving so well were on the same material as those who were much superior. In New Zealand schools...
Did they have streaming in the classes, though? So
in those schools I'm talking about, no. And here, I was just going on to say that we'd have grouped our kids within classes so that we'd look at what levels they'd achieved and we'd try and provide learning for them at a particular level that was appropriate. And that was quite a challenge for me as a teacher. Wasn't easy at all.
So you were teaching to start with for some time, then you moved over into the psychology side?
Yeah, psychological service, as it was.
So how did that transition take place?
You got married.
It was as a result of my completing university studies. Firstly, I had a bachelor's degree and moved on and completed a master's. And the way things operated then, having that master's degree gave me access into not just the psychological service, but also into becoming a psychologist and to be eligible to be regarded as such. There were other things which, you know, I won't try and remember because it became complicated. But basically when that happened, your range of work changed. So I wasn't working as somebody just with backward or intellectually handicapped children. I gradually assumed a much wider range of work.
So then with tomorrow's schools coming in, did that change the way these things were handled?
Yes, it did. Gradually over a period of time, the nature of the work we did became more and more constrained. So we would work under a direction that you work only with the more severely disabled.
This was after Tomorrow Schools?
Yes.
Okay.
And so referrals coming in from schools, you basically looked at them and determined that there were ones that you couldn't deal with. So it was progressively the, I want to say worst, but that's not what I mean.
Most
challenging pupils, whether intellectually or behaviourally or sensorily. And I think now that particular aspect is still true.
There's a lot of talk, you don't hear it so much now, but about things like Ritalin and attention deficit disorder. Is that something that has been recognised more recently, or it's a long-term issue?
No, the use of Ritalin in particular would go back into the 70s, late 70s, and you had all sorts of input. There was one particular rural school that I remember going to where a public health nurse had come in, a school nurse had come in, and she'd given all the kids in the school sort of eyes over, and she determined that in the school there were 93 children that she thought were distractible and should be on Ritalin or something like that. The next step beyond that...
That's most of the children in a
rural
school.
It was about 25%, I think.
Yeah.
A phenomenal percentage. And some of them would have then been referred to a paediatric specialist, paediatrician, visiting the area. And I recall one particular place where virtually every child that was seen was then put onto Ritalin with the parents' agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that there was any improvement. There were one or two cases that I recall dealing with where you go into a class and the kid had no attention span whatever. And after administration of Ritalin, yes, they were much quieter and much more directed and focused on what mm-hmm. learning tasks were. But they were, to me, quite rare.
Okay.
And so, that was a phase that you went through, and not all the paediatricians agreed with that way of looking at things, fortunately. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. But behavioural problems were sort of considered quite widespread.
Well, behaviour problems stem from a lot of different sources. And, I don't want to get into those sources because they're many and varied.
Yeah.
I mean, you can start talking about learned behaviours, for example, and then start thinking about where the learning occurred. And then you talk about re-education.
Yeah. Was it gendered? Was it mainly boys were restless?
I think boys overwhelmingly were the ones identified as having behaviour problems, but not solely.
And then there was, I suppose, there's been changes in the idea of acceptable discipline in schools. So would that have affected?
Well, we came into a period where, and I don't remember the dates for this, but where physical punishment, corporal punishment, was abolished, if you will. Teachers weren't allowed to strike children anymore. And previous to that, corporal punishment would have been used, but once it had gone, there had been teachers who rued the day that happened, but then basically I don't think they'd learned the strategies to replace it. And so dealing with kids who were challenging in classrooms, it was quite an important issue. And a lot of work done by psychologists involved training teachers to adapt to adopt different approaches to things, and that in itself was quite interesting, working with teachers that way.
So how the and they developed alternative strategies that were effective?
At times, but when I say at times, it really depended on the amount of time they were given the opportunity to focus on such things. If you think about training and how much you get to do, and I used to look at the private sector business, and I'd talk to one or two people, one or two of those people we know quite well, and I'd say, well, you know, your staff, how much training a year would they get, like in service training? They'd talk about a week or 10 days. And I'd think about such things as, how long does it take to acquire a new skill? So it's you know, 100 days or whatever. And I'd look at the fact that teachers, if they were lucky, might get 1 day's in service a year. Might get two. But the most successful in service I remember being associated with was where we had a group of teachers that were able to take out of their classrooms for a day, a week, over a period of several weeks, have a break and then go back and do it again. And having a number of contacts with those teachers in subsequent years where they referred back to that period as having been immensely helpful, and things that they were, had learned to do that they were still doing. Which illustrated the point quite well, but there was never formal research to demonstrate that. People knew things, but...
But that wasn't the norm for teacher in service training?
No, no.
Okay. And do you think then that, well, you did mention Ritalin and behavioural problems, do you think that might have been used instead of some of the corporal punishment?
I have no way of being able to comment on that. Did you say with corporal punishment?
No, instead, oh, you were saying earlier in the early days there was corporal punishment, and then they couldn't use that, they needed other strategies. Would you say, well, these children aren't
no, behaviour? I wouldn't draw any relationship between those. I think the probably most prescriptions of Ritalin arise from parental referrals to a paediatrician through their GP. I can't cope with him, you know, he's really bad all the time, rather than there being efforts to change a parent's behaviour. Because the bottom line is that a kid's behaviour won't change without there being changes in the behaviour of the adults around them. And you had to have parents who were agreeable to go along with what you were suggesting and to persevere with it.
So a lot of your work as a psychologist with these children was working, trying to work with the parents on strategies for the children?
Yeah, that was an important part of what you were doing, definitely.
Now also, I suppose there's been changes in family structure and far more, there's a term sole parent family, but did you observe implications of that?
Not specifically in terms of, you know, keeping statistics or anything like that. But we were aware that there were situations where single parent families had markedly more challenges than perhaps two parent families. But that's an oversimplification, really, because you can't look at the factors involved.
You say challenges. What do you mean by that?
I'm using that as a neutral term, so it's not finger pointing.
But in general, is it challenges in terms of issues with the children, or just financial difficulties, or so?
Yeah, all of those.
Right across the board. Well, I have a good. Probably wrap up at that because we've got 25 minutes.
Thanks for that.
Thank you very much. That was interesting.